Hello there. Today's Wednesday, May the 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump fires the man in charge of the Russian investigation.
I told the president, Mr. President, with all due respect, you are making a big mistake.
South Korea's new president wants better relations with the North. Some students in the U.S. may have invented a unique way to test for TB. Also ahead, a documentary about ordinary Syrians doing extraordinary things for other citizens. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the director of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, James Comey, has been fired. President Donald Trump, in a letter to Comey on Tuesday, told him, "You are hereby terminated and removed from office effective immediately." The president adding that Comey is, quote, not able to effectively lead the bureau. FBI directors are appointed for a single 10-year term. Comey was appointed 4 years ago. He was in California when he was informed by staff of his firing. Democratic Senate leader Chuck Schumer made a brief statement condemning the firing in the midst of an investigation into Russia's election meddling.
This is part of a deeply troubling pattern from the Trump administration. They fired Sally Yates. They fired Preet Bharara. And now they fired Director Comey, the very man leading the investigation. This does not seem to be a coincidence.
Joining me now for more on this breaking news is former U.S. Attorney General under President George W. Bush, Alberto Gonzalez. Thank you so much for being with us. What is your take on the president firing the man at the head of this agency investigating whether his campaign colluded with Russia?
First of all, listen, I get no pleasure from anyone being fired, and I have to honor Jim's sacrifice and the sacrifice of his family and his public service. My own view is that if the president terminated Jim Comey in order to stop an investigation of perhaps his involvement or his team's involvement with Russia, that would be wrong, and that would be stupid because I think the investigation is going to continue anyway without Jim Comey. If, on the other hand, the firing was based upon the recommendation of a career prosecutor who's well-respected, Rod Rosenstein, which in his letter he describes various actions taken by Jim Comey over the past year, which are in violation of department policies and did not reflect good judgment, then I support the removal. The president certainly within his right to look carefully at the recommendation of both the attorney general and the deputy attorney general and make a decision for the good of the department and for the good of the FBI. This is a right decision.
But if the president is now going to be in charge of appointing someone new to head the investigation that is overseeing an investigation regarding his presidential campaign and Russia's involvement in potentially trying to influence the election, doesn't that pose a conflict?
That'll be a decision to be made by the new FBI director, that whether or not he believes he can credibly lead an investigation that the American people will have confidence in. But, you know, Congress is also involved in doing their own investigation. And so, you know, obviously it creates an additional hurdle for the new FBI director to do the steps that are going to be absolutely necessary to instill confidence in the impartiality of that investigation in the minds of Congress and in the minds of the American people, but not necessarily a conflict. That'll be a decision, a calculation that has to be made by the new FBI director. And it may be someone that everyone has total confidence. So I think that we just have to wait and see in terms of who that person is going to be. But again, you've got career FBI investigators. You've got good people at the Department of Justice who have also career individuals. They're going to be very interested in seeing that this move forward to the extent there's evidence there of any wrongdoing, any connection with the Russian involvement. I would call it a dumb move by the president if he thinks he's going to stop that investigation.
How unusual is this? And certainly,
well, extraordinary.
Why now?
I mean, listen, think about how many times an FBI director has been fired. I think only one time. Jed Sessions was fired by President Clinton. It's unusual, quite frankly. I have a problem with the way it was done. If in fact Jim Comey's on the West Coast and he receives the news while on the West Coast, I have a problem with that personally. I don't think that's how you treat people. But, you know, the president is only within his legal right to make this kind of decision and to make it in the way that it was made.
It sounds like Mr. Comey was actually found out through the media.
I think that's very unfortunate. I wouldn't want to be treated that way. I think that I would deserve the courtesy of a phone call. I know the lessons of, you know, being respectful when you're removing someone.
Is there any reason to believe that this was due to how James Comey handled the situation with Hillary Clinton's personal email server? Because up until this point, all we've heard from the president, particularly during the campaign, was praise of how Comey handled the situation.
I was on record, even when Jim Comey did the press conference in July, I questioned it, how the FBI director could sort of usurp the authority of the prosecutor, the attorney general, or the deputy attorney general in making the decision as to whether or not to move forward with an indictment. The role of the FBI is to gather up the evidence and present the evidence to the prosecutor. Now, as a former deputy attorney general, I would have been interested in Jim Comey's views about a possible indictment, but those should only have been recommendations. The FBI director should not be making these kind of pronouncements without having the attorney general by his side.
And but so, why now?
I can't answer that question. I'm not privy to discussions and the decisions made within the White House. And obviously, that's created somewhat of a firestorm for this White House in terms of the timing. Most people would agree that they question some of the decisions and the actions taken by the FBI director. I know some Democrats are saying it's because the White House felt that Comey was getting too close to the White House in connection with the Russian investigation. I don't know whether that's true or not, but again, if that's the reason is to head off the investigation, I think it's on a fool's errand. You know, President Nixon fired Archibald Cox. He fired the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, before the Associate Attorney General fired Archibald Cox. So people were fired, but you know what? The investigation continued, and President Nixon ultimately resigned. In Washington today, if the evidence is there, the investigation is going to continue.
In his termination letter, the president said he was grateful that Comey had told him three times that he is not under investigation. How likely is it that James Comey would have had that type of a conversation with the president?
I think it would be unlikely, quite frankly. But even if that were true, to include it in this letter was purely self-serving from my perspective. I don't understand it. Everyone who's read the letter looks at that and says, huh, why is this in here? I don't think it was appropriate. Obviously, the president's the president, and he can say whatever he wants to in dismissing someone that works for him. I think it was an unfortunate phrase used by the president. So whether or not it's true or not, I can't confirm that. But I just think that was not very helpful to the president's image before the American people.
Any other final thoughts on what has transpired?
I think what I'd like to say is that, you know, the FBI is a great institution, and they've got great people there, and it will continue to function and will continue to serve the American people. You know, the president will soon nominate someone, and the Senate will do its best to ensure that that person nominated is in fact someone that can be independent of the White House. And so it's sort of wait and see now what's going to happen.
All right. Well, we certainly do appreciate your taking the time to talk to us. Former U.S. Attorney General under President George W. Bush, Alberto Gonzalez. Well, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said Tuesday that American forces in Afghanistan face a determined enemy but are dealing with significant blows to the enemy. Speaking at a news conference in Copenhagen, along with his Danish counterpart, Mattis said both the Islamic State group and al-Qaeda are losing ground and power in Afghanistan.
The government under President Ghani and Chief Executive Abdullah are committed to working in a responsive way with their citizens. And therein lies the path forward. When a government wins the affection, the respect, and the support of their people, then no enemy can stand against them.
The comments from Mattis come as U.S. media report the Trump administration may significantly increase the number of U.S. troops and intensify the fight in Afghanistan. According to some reports, President Trump is weighing whether to send as many as 5,000 more troops to Afghanistan. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer was asked about it during his daily briefing with reporters.
He is going to do everything he can to fight radical Islamic terrorism, to root out and destroy ISIS. In some cases, if ISIS, where he has to go into Afghanistan, they may be synonymous at that point, but they are not always the same, right? You can be in, the goal is always going to be defeat ISIS, which is something that he's been very clear on with the American people from the get-go.
U.S. and Afghan officials announced recently that Abdul Hasib, the head of so-called Islamic State in Afghanistan, had been killed days ago in a military raid. He was believed to have been behind an attack that killed 50 people in a Kabul military hospital earlier this year. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. bracing for continued Russian cyber attacks. The ACLU issues a travel alert for the state of Texas. Anti-Muslim hate crimes surge reported in the U.S. The first Cambodian-American woman elected to U.S. public office. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, the United States has vowed to continue the alliance with South Korea to tackle threats from North Korea after Moon Jae-in, a human rights lawyer and the son of a refugee from North Korea, declared victory in the South Korean presidential election Tuesday. He was sworn in on Wednesday. Voter turnout was historically high following a tumultuous political period following the ouster of Park Geun-hye, who was caught up in a corruption scandal. VOA's Victor Beatty asked for reaction from RAND Corporation senior international defense researcher Bruce Bennett.
He was clearly the leader. He was what we were anticipating. And I think we have to wait to see what policies he's going to adopt. Just like with President Trump running for president, he said a lot of things in the campaign and then adjusted his views afterwards. So it will be interesting to see.
This son of North Korean refugees takes the helm at a time of tension with North Korea. He's indicated he wants to reach out in a pro-engagement policy reminiscent of some of his predecessors. Is that at odds with U.S. policy?
President Trump has been talking on and off about negotiating with North Korea in the last few days, so not entirely clear that it is contrary to U.S. policy. It's certainly different from what many Americans have been expecting in terms of a hardline policy of possible military strikes. That's not something that Moon Jae-in is going to be prepared to work with.
Is he going to harden any opposition to deployment of the THAAD U.S. anti-missile system?
Well, and that's really one of the key issues right now. During the campaign, he was clearly speaking to his supporters in saying that that needed to be reevaluated. I'm sure he will do a reevaluation. But it's not clear that he will conclude that THAAD shouldn't be deployed. He may well decide that that is really something that Seoul needs to operate from a position of strength against North Korea.
Well, Bruce, this election is probably the best outcome for North Korea. How might it impact North Korean policy? Will this joint venture at Kaesong industrial venture reopen, perhaps?
Oh, yes. Moon Jae-in has definitely been very strong about wanting to reopen the Kaesong Industrial Complex. The big question is going to be, what will he need to do to deal with the UN Security Council resolution that would say that he's not to do that? So does he go back to the UN Security Council? Does he cut an agreement with some of the powers before he goes to do that? That's all something we don't know. It will be interesting to see what strategy he implements.
The White House Tuesday was quick to congratulate Mr. Moon on his landslide victory and, quote, we look forward to working with the president-elect to continue to strengthen the alliance between the U.S. and the Republic of Korea. What will relations look like, say, in 6 months?
Well, that all depends upon what happens in the next month or two, I think. If President-elect Moon Jae-in is prepared to really work with the Americans, set out a path to deal with reopening the Kaesong Industrial Complex, offsetting the subsidy that that would give to the North Korean military programs, and if he decides to accept THAAD, things could be very good in 6 months. Alternatively, if he is very confrontational with President Trump, things could be quite different, and we just don't know how things are going to develop.
That's RAND Corporation senior international defense researcher Bruce Bennett. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news. Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues. A group of college students in the United States have invented something that could have huge implications worldwide in fighting tuberculosis. Project manager Samin Youssef is a senior honors bioengineering student at George Mason University, here to talk about it. So thanks for being with us. Tell us all about what you've been doing.
So we are a group of four bioengineering students at George Mason University, and we are working on designing a diagnostic test for tuberculosis for our senior design project. Our device is meant to work as a first line of defense screening system for TB, and it functions like a regular electronic pregnancy test. However, what makes it unique is that we use nanotrap technology to capture the TB biomarker in the urine. And these particles have a built-in chemistry lab in them, so basically once you add the sample, you'll have a diagnostic within 10 minutes.
So you've basically invented new tools similar to a home pregnancy test to test for TB?
Yes, absolutely.
And do they work?
Yes, they do work. We have done 50 trials so far and in the lab, and we have seen that the electrical and visual systems have worked pretty well so far.
Fascinating. And so where do you go from here with something like this?
This summer, we're going to be doing a clinical trial with samples collected from Lima, Peru. And the sample records are extremely detailed, and that's thanks to our collaborators at Johns Hopkins University who collected each of these samples.
What made you guys decide to do something like this, to take something like this on in the first place?
We as undergraduates spend a lot of time with our heads in textbooks, and Mason really focuses on students growing into scholars by having the opportunity to see the application of the ideas that we learn in the classroom. And we've been fortunate enough to have the mentorship and financial support to embark on designing a rapid diagnostic. And we decided to focus on TB because we think it's crazy that one-third of the world's population is still affected by it. And 40% of this population goes undiagnosed and therefore untreated. So we think that a rapid diagnostic could really help, and we decided to design one for our senior design project.
If all continues to go well, where do you see this going? Do you see this emerging as something that would be used here and abroad on a regular basis? And if so, what's the time frame for actually seeing something like this actually be utilized?
We definitely see this project becoming integrated part into primary care facilities as well as immigration clinics and those types of settings. But eventually, we'd really love to see it like an at-home test, the same way that pregnancy tests are used. In terms of our timeline, we're really just focused on this next year of just validating it and making sure it works in the clinical with our clinical trials. And from there, we're hoping we can have FDA approval and things like that.
All right. We appreciate it. Thanks for being with us and telling us about it. Good luck with it. Project manager Samin Youssef. She is a senior honors bioengineering student at George Mason University. Turning now to what's trending on social media. Andrew Palchewski's here. Hi, Andrew. What's happening?
This one is an interesting announcement, though. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a long-term announcement.
Okay.
It's part of a year-long project that they've just finished as part of Facebook's artificial intelligence research team. And they've announced, and I have to read this quote because this is great, they've used a novel conventional neural network approach for language translation that achieves state-of-the-art accuracy at 9 times the speed of recurrent neural systems. In layman's terms, it means they found a new way to do translation. Now, if you type your text into your status on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
it translates it into another language. You can translate it. Or if you see somebody's status in another language, there's a little button that says see translation. You can click on that. Now, this system that they've discovered, designed, is going to make it 9 times faster to translate things. Now, the way translating works now on the internet is it translates it like you read a book. It does it line by line, word by word, as it kind of goes through linearly. This does it piece by piece, and they say it can better pick up context and other things. So sometimes when you translate something to a different language and it gets garbled or the meaning isn't quite right, they say this is going to make that much less of a factor.
What else is going on?
So an update on a story that we talked about a month ago. There was a young man, Carter Wilkerson, who tweeted at the Wendy's restaurant. Mm-hmm. Wendy's, of course, has a very great social media team, very funny, very witty, very sharp, where they write kind of snarky comments at people. So he wrote to Wendy's, tweeted at them, and asked how many retweets until he gets a lifetime of their chicken nuggets.
Right, I remember.
And Wendy said 18 million. He said, consider it done. And when we last talked about this, he had about 2 million retweets and ways to go. Well,
yeah. He
hasn't gotten to the 18 million, but as of Tuesday, has the most retweeted tweet in the world.
What? Nearly
3.5 million retweets and growing.
Kidding.
Yeah. The previous record holder, as we talked about, was Ellen DeGeneres' selfie tweet from the 2014 Academy Awards that she hosted.
Fascinating.
That tweet had Bradley Cooper, Jennifer Lawrence, Meryl Streep in it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so that tweet has 3.43 million tweets, give or take a few, you know, 10,000s or so.
Mm-hmm.
And he has nearly 3.5 million retweets
on
his tweets. People are astounded by this.
You would think Wendy's would be just saying, okay, we'll give it to you. Don't worry about it.
People are tweeting, they said they can't believe it, and Wendy's replied, believe it. Nuggets are important. And what Wendy's did was they gave him, I don't know if it's a lifetime supply of nuggets,
uh-huh.
but they gave him, he's holding up a picture where he has a bunch of, looks like Wendy's gift cards in his hand. And they're also, this is the nice part, they're donating $100,000 to the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. Dave Thomas, of course, is the founders of Wendy's. They said that he did such a good job to make this the most retweeted tweet mm-hmm. ever in the world that they're going to reward him with some chicken nuggets, and they're going to make a nice donation. So he's very excited. He's using the hashtag Nugs for Carter. And he tweeted out, he said, we did it, guys. Thanks to your help and support, we were able to raise $100,000 for the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption and beat the Ellen DeGeneres Show record. Now let's get to 18 million. So it sounds like he's going to keep striving for that 18 million mark now that he already has the record, and we'll see if he can get to that 18 million. And then I think he's going to be in for some big rewards.
No doubt. Very cool.
Yeah.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
All right. Well, you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. In Aleppo, Syria, while the Bashar al-Assad regime played a big role in destroying the city and its inhabitants with barrel bombs and airstrikes, many civilians did risk their lives to rescue the wounded and drag the dead from the rubble. Since 2013, the volunteers from all walks of life have created what's called the Syrian Civil Defense, known to the world as the White Helmets. Well, Syrian filmmaker Firas Fayyad delivers an unprecedented testimonial of their sacrifices in the besieged city, partly controlled by the rebels until December. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with Fayyad about his new documentary.
In the middle of ruins, Khaled, a white helmet husband and father of two, is one of the last men left in Aleppo, rushing against time to pull the injured trapped under buildings toppled by incessant bombings by the Assad regime, the Russians, and ISIS. Most of the victims are children, says award-winning Syrian filmmaker Firas Fayyad.
A lot of people, they don't know that there is civilians' life in Aleppo. They think just a city of the wars. It's like a market. It's houses with the families. It's a people who is fighting for our common values in the world. Nobody care. Nobody act. And the Syrians, they feel disappointed from waiting.
Last Men in Aleppo focuses on those Syrians who choose to stay. Fayyad's documentary is an indictment of crimes against humanity, but it is also about compassion and resilience. In the middle of destruction, people still find joy among friends and family. Khaled builds a fish pond for his children. Fayyad, in cooperation with the Aleppo Media Center and citizen journalists who contributed to this film, risked their lives to record the day-to-day white helmet operations in Aleppo.
I start with this idea that the war bring the baddest things in our human being, but also it's bring the best in our human being.
Nowadays, the filmmaker lives in exile. He was imprisoned twice by the Assad regime and would face death should he return to Syria.
I have the feeling of the anger from the Russian, of course. I have the anger from Assad regime who's kept killing the Syrian till now and every day. Now I'm sitting here in the studio and Assad bombing a place next to my family that's still living in Syria and could lose my family in any time.
And while the film focuses on those Syrians who choose to stay in their war-torn country, it also helps us empathize with those who leave. During the filming of this documentary, Khaled, like countless others, was killed, saving his neighbors. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us today, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Donald Trump is determined to maintain the United States as a global energy leader and foster energy security for the American people. To that end, he recently signed an executive order aimed at encouraging energy exploration and production, including on the outer continental shelf, while at the same time ensuring that any such activity is safe and environmentally responsible. At the signing of the America First Offshore Energy Executive Order April 28th, President Trump pointed out that the United States is blessed with incredible natural resources, including abundant offshore oil and natural gas reserves.
But the federal government has kept 94% of these offshore areas closed for exploration and production. This deprives our country of potentially thousands and thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in wealth.
The executive order directs the Secretary of the Interior to review the current 5-year development plan on U.S. offshore oil and gas explorations, as well as evaluate the regulations and permitting process for development in seismic research. The order also directs the Secretary of Commerce to refrain from designating any new marine monuments and sanctuaries or expanding existing ones, and to review the marine monuments or sanctuaries designated under the Antiquities Act within the last 10 years. In a briefing to reporters, Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke said the president's executive order puts the United States on track for energy independence. Such independence, he noted, is key for a variety of reasons. It is a boon for job creation in the United States, where reliable, abundant, and affordable energy is a requirement in order to be competitive in manufacturing. In regard to the environment, it is far preferable that energy be produced in the United States under reasonable regulations than have it produced overseas with no regulations. America leads the world in environmental and safety precautions and protections, and we will continue that mission, he said. Lastly, Secretary Zinke defined energy independence as a matter of national security. It is better to produce energy here than be held hostage by foreign entities. And producing it here, he noted, will enable us to provide our allies with energy as well. President Trump called the executive order a move toward unleashing American energy and an historic step toward a future with greater prosperity and security for all Americans.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.